Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 255 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, Claire Harmon speaks with Carolyn Sanderson about the painstaking and sometimes obsessive art of literary biography and how careful detective work can bring new insights into even the most written about lives.
The award-winning Claire Harmon is one of our foremost literary biographers, with illuminating and meticulously researched lives of Sylvia Townsend Warner, Fanny Burney, Robert Louis Stevenson, and Charlotte Bronte to her name, as well as Jane's fame, an account of how Jane Austen gained her worldwide renown. She's also written Murder by the Book, about the gruesome murder of Lord William Russell in 1840, and how the killer may have been influenced by a popular novel of the day. Claire Harmon is also a poet, short story writer, critic, and professor of creative writing at Durham University. I spoke to her at her home in Oxford, where, among other things, she has a garden bench that once belonged to her first subject, Sylvia Townsend Warner. Claire, I've always found it really fascinating to discover how biographers choose their subjects. But I believe that in the case of your first subject, Sylvia Townsend Warner, she sort of found you.
Well, in a way she did, yes. She was under a desk. Her works, her poems were under a desk. And I was cleaning up the office where the desk lived and said, "What's this?" in a big old powder bag. She'd died the year before and left a big bunch of unpublished poems to the publisher in whose office I was working. So, yes, it really did present itself as a strange sort of unknown packet by an unknown writer. I mean, I had no idea who Sylvia Townsend Warner was, much to my shame, I think. But, yes, so I got involved in a rather sort of strange way with that subject. And, of course, I was a very young person and I hadn't written a biography before, but I really almost immediately fell in love with her work and found it very peculiar and challenging and absorbing. And then after a couple of years when I'd been working on things to do with her poetry and editing a sort of essay compilation about her work, the estate asked me to write her biography, and it was a very surprising request, you know, to begin with, to be asked to do anything so formal and important when you're a very young person and have not written a book yet. So, yes, I did then sort of instantly become a biographer. It's rather like sort of pouring water on a dehydrated, you know, Japanese flower or something, and then whoosh. So I was very, very fortunate in that way. And, yeah, so she did find me in many ways.
You had no thoughts of writing biography up to that point, because you're also a poet and short story writer. Had you written before at that point?
Well, I was barely out of nappies, actually, at this point. I was so young. That's the good part of my career has been that I have not had any period in it when I had to yearn to be a writer, because it happened very, very early through this editing job, first on Warner's poetry, followed by being asked to be her biographer. And, of course, I mean, I had actually wanted to be a poet since the nappy period, and I still write poetry, and that's a totally different story, you know, what one actually thinks you're going to be doing in writing and what you end up actually doing. Not that the non-fiction that I've been writing for 30 years or more is in any way sort of inferior in my mind to what I would have been writing had I been recognised in those other genres, but it's certainly the way that a career, professional career, tends to go, isn't it? I mean, you know, you do one type of book and on the whole, publishers quite like you to do the same type of book. And sometimes they like you to do the same book really under a different package. You know, they like you to keep within the same period or the same gender of subject. And, that, you know, there is a sort of cumulative effect that a wise publisher, certainly, and sometimes a wise writer might keep to, which is to have a unified seeming career, whereas the individual might very much want to have a totally random and, you know, haphazard career that answers certain creative and imaginative needs more obviously.
Yes. So that first biography of Sylvia Townsend Warner went on to win the John Llewellyn Rees Prize for a book written by an author under the age of 35. It was published in 1989. Did that recognition, that very early recognition, did that make you think I've found my métier here?
It ought to have done. And now, you know, when I look back at my sort of 33-year-old self, I wish to be more motherly towards her and say, oh, you know, well done, dear, that was great. But at the time, I sort of thought, I mean, not really consciously, but I thought, well, it had taken me about 8 years to write that Warner book. It had been extremely absorbing. I couldn't imagine, A, finding another subject quite as riveting, B, having the energy to enter into it and to make it into a career. I didn't see myself as necessarily writing another Life of a Writer. So it didn't have that stimulating sort of effect, really. I just felt a little bit like sort of postpartum melancholy about, you know, well, I've expended a huge amount of effort on this first book. Now what do I do? So, yes.
I mean, since you wrote that book, you have indeed gone on to write more literary biographies and three more what I suppose one would describe as cradle-to-grave biographies, Fanny Burney, Robert Louis Stevenson and Charlotte Bronte. And I wondered if you start each one with a slightly different mission. I mean, obviously with Sylvia Townsend Warner, she was little known at that time and presumably, in your view, underrated as well. Fanny Burney, probably a little bit the same, although I've read that with her, it was about getting under the skin of all the things that she had carefully said about herself. And then Robert Louis Stevenson, a writer, I guess, who produced a huge body of work, but is known for a couple of novels, really.
Yes.
So there's a sort of different impetus for each one.
Yes, very much so. And actually, the first two books were extremely unlike each other, I thought, the first two subjects, because the Warner book, you know, she was recently dead. It was a story that had to be discovered and then told. You know, I mean, nobody actually even knew the chronology of her life. I was really trying to find where she was when, you know, I had to put that all together, which was very complicated and strange. Whereas Burney's life has been much documented, not least by herself. And, you know, many scholars have written about Burney. So I felt, and she's been dead a much longer time.
Because there are huge, there's a huge extent of journals and letters for
enormous.
Burney,
I mean, she was an extraordinarily, almost incontinent letter and journal writer, which is very interesting. And it was that peculiarity of the Burney archive that dealing with it just made me realise how controlling a person she was, controlling of her own posterity. And that was very interesting as a biographer to go into that subject and try to read her account of it against what might have been happening and what actually factually was happening and what other people said was happening. But it was a historical venture as well. You know, there was nobody around, obviously, that I could talk to or be distracted by, because a lot of the Warner friends and some of the associates were still very much alive, and several of them were kicking in the early 1980s. You know, so you have, with a warmly dead subject, you have all that to deal with too, the social side of it. So they were, Warner and Burney were very, very different subjects to both research and to be able to write about. You know, the way you write about somebody does very much matter. You know, it matters how dead they are, really.
Yes. I think it's very interesting when you think about different biographies and different subjects that, of course, sometimes you have an absolutely daunting amount of material to draw on, as you're describing for Fanny Burney. And then in other cases, you have huge gaps. I mean, one thinks immediately of Jane Austen and the huge gaps, the things that we really don't know about her life. And they both present a challenge to the biographer, but a different challenge, I guess.
Yes, they certainly do. Because, as you say, you know, Austen is famously underrepresented in terms of personal papers. Whether she kept diaries or whatever, we don't know. The letters, there are only 161 letters remaining from Austen. And it's actually blissful, isn't it, after you've dealt with the sea of Burney material, to then have a very poignantly small cache of personal writing, which, of course, as you know, I wrote about in my book about Austen, is one of the reasons why people are so quick to imagine they know Jane Austen, because she doesn't contradict that through a lot of diaries that might show us anything, but they certainly might point up that slightly acid tone that comes across in some of her letters. You know, this a slightly unlovable trait comes through in some of the letters. But she clearly was a very private and secretive person too. And I think there's a lot of, what one could say, meat, biographical meat on Jane Austen, that it's, it does rely on a sort of speculative leap, of course, and on some lateral thinking about her, really, rather than just looking at the known facts on their own. I think those 161 letters repay very, very close reading. They seem to be mostly, and they are mostly about everyday matters, the price of muslin, or, you know, who was at such and such an event. But there are things in them that indicate all sorts of strains of ways of thinking. She's very keen on statistics, and she's very keen on a kind of a way of seeing spaces too. And I mean, it sounds a bit airy-fairy, but I mean, those things come through if you read them very much one at a time or on their own.
Yes, so from that apparent dearth of material, you find great depth, just as you were saying, in individual letters. Your book on Austen is Jane's Fame, How Jane Austen Conquered the World. It's completely fascinating chronology, really, of Jane Austen's reputation and how it's grown and why it's grown in the way that it has. Were you ever tempted to write a more conventional biography of Jane Austen?
Yes, very much so. I really wanted to write a conventional biography of Austen way back before I wrote the Burney book, actually. I wrote the Burney book because I wasn't able to write the Austen book. I wrote a proposal for a biography of Austen, and then found out that there were a couple of other big books in the pipeline for 1995. And I'm not quite sure why there was this excitement in 1995, apart from the fact the letters were coming, an edition of the letters were coming out. But the Claire Tomlin book came out that year,
yes,
and the David Noakes book. And there was really just no chance of getting a contract to write a book on Austen when these big hitters were coming up with these. So you have to stand aside if there's, you know, if you're a professional writer and can't get a contract, then you really are sort of left holding that thought.
Yes, that's a very interesting demonstration of how it can be as much about timing when these sort of books come out, isn't it?
Yes, and I think that held even more true at that date, because I think we've now gone past the era of the golden age of biography, as some people call it. you know, when there were big books coming out and large advances for a literary biography. But at the time, you know, there was very clearly a pecking order and a sort of both writers and subjects, and I wasn't able to write about Austen then. But of course, you know, she's a very insistent presence in everybody's imagination, and I really wanted to write about her in some form or other. And the first part of that book is a sort of biographical section, and then it's more like a literary critical section, the rest of it. I loved writing, thinking about her as an unsuccessful writer. It's so hard to think of a very, very, very famous figure like Jane Austen as unfamous. It's hard for us to unpick her from her fame and to see her as an actual person. Writing works we now consider to be works of undoubted genius, and they are works of undoubted genius which nobody is acknowledging or reading or publishing back when the writer herself was alive. And the sort of agony of being that satirist and that mind and not being successful, I find very, very poignant and instructive, that you could be Jane Austen and be unpublished for 20 years. And it, you know, it's not a matter of her then being discovered like J.K. Rowling or something. I mean, she was published in her own lifetime, but by that time she had really had to live with not having an audience. And what that does to you, I think it probably made it impossible for her really to relish her success. I think she relished it privately, but she'd always had to nurture her own satisfactions within her own family circle, primarily just with her sister and one or two very close friends. And just being Jane Austen under those circumstances, I find very, very interesting. You know, people just forget about it, really. They forget that her adult life was one of disappointment and anxiety and frustration, sort of creative frustration.
You were talking there about a literary biography of big subjects and that difficulty of timing, you know, the fact that there were a couple of big books coming out on Jane Austen at one particular time. And it makes me think about those lives, tackling lives which have already been very well documented. So one obviously couldn't say that of Sylvia Townsend Warner. One could say that to a certain extent about Fanny Burney, but there probably hadn't been a sort of, in inverted commas, popular biography of her. Your biography of Charlotte Bronte, however, I mean, that's very much a life that had already been documented. And I suppose in the case of the Bronte sisters, I mean, it's the stuff of legend and renown. I mean, I think I first heard the story of the Bronte sisters on Blue Peter and was just riveted by the idea of these three sisters, you know, living in on the Yorkshire moors and all being writers. So when you take a subject like Charlotte Bronte, and so much writing about her has gone before, what are you trying to do? Are you trying to, you know, literally unearth something that nobody else has managed to unearth by some miracle? You're going to be the person that does it. Or are you trying to bring a personal take, or are you trying to correct misconceptions, or maybe a bit of all of those things?
Well, I certainly wasn't trying to correct misconceptions. I didn't have a kind of mission with that. And I was very reluctant to take on a subject that is so well known, that, you know, has so many fans, extremely well-informed people, has been written so often, you know, and it's just such a charmingly strange story, isn't it? Everybody is intrigued. As you were saying, you first came across it on Blue Peter. It was probably like not a Ladybird book, but in a sort of a girls' magazine or something.
It's that sort of wonderful story, isn't it?
Yes, almost like a totally engrossing and very appealing, obviously, to young people, especially young girls. You know, and Jane Eyre, Wuthering Heights, these great classic works, especially which do appeal to people often in their teenage years, and then you carry on reading those books all your life. So, I mean, I was thinking, oh, goodness, I can't do this. I had a friend who kept saying, well, you really ought to do this. And the bicentenary coming up made it plausible to want to have a new book. But I didn't go into that body of material thinking, I've got to have a USP here. I've got to find, you know, like Charlotte Bronte was, you know, fill in the gaps for something sensational at all. But I did want to, as I do with all my subjects, enter into their works and their world and just see what I could make of it in terms of just asking questions. Because the thing with very, very well-known subjects is that quite often questions cease to be asked. I mean, the sort of question you would ask about a friend's life, if somebody was telling you something, you know, or about another person, you say, well, why did they do that? Or, you know, what made them go back to so-and-so? Or surely they couldn't afford such and such. It's just ordinary questions about people's lives, which in this myth-making that goes on around well-known writers, you tend to stop asking those questions. But if you, you know, just kind of go, especially to people's letters and going into Bronte's letters and reading them and just thinking, oh, well, you know, why on earth didn't she, or what was that about? It inevitably, even if it doesn't throw up some, you know, staggering fact, it will just give you a sense of them as an actual, a real person. It kind of, it frees them slightly from the mythologizing. It quite often makes the story less tellable and less knowable, because some hard and fast facts about writers' lives turn out to be mythologies or, you know, romanticisings. And so you end up with something that's a little bit fragmented and fluffy around the edges, or frayed around the edges. But to me, that's what the whole project is about. It's about imaginatively and factually engaging with a body of material. And, you know, as it, not necessarily overturning anything, but just letting people see that you can treat that person as a real person, not a person in fantasy or myth.
And rather wonderfully of Charlotte Bronte, I read something, I think, that you write on your website, of all the subjects I have written about, hers is the most unquiet ghost, which is a rather sad thing to be left thinking.
Well, indeed, because she had a very sad life, didn't she? I mean, I was just talking about Charlotte Bronte just the other day to somebody, and they said, well, she didn't have much fun. And that's absolutely correct. I mean, none of the Bronte siblings really had many pleasures. And the paucity of pleasure, even simple things like exciting food every once in a while. You know, they had, their diet was terrible, their, you know, the conditions were genteel poverty. I mean, they didn't have enough money, they couldn't travel. They managed it, obviously, extremely well, but they just didn't have enough pleasure in their lives. And they obviously had a huge tragedy as well, and Charlotte, being the last of the siblings, you know, had to undergo the really unbearable bereavements of Branwell, then Emily and Anne. And how she managed at all is kind of really impossible to understand. But yes, I did feel that her bravery in persisting in establishing herself as a writer. I mean, she hammered on till she got published. She completely wanted to have her voice heard, and her lack of control over that was what made her youth quite miserable. She did manage to get into print, and that was incredibly gratifying for her. But it was going on at the same time as all these awful personal tragedies. And really, there's just no point in her life when she was free of care, really, when she didn't have something that was garrotting her with difficulty or pain. And it's very hard to live with somebody when you're writing a book about them and you live with them for so many years, and to just feel so sorry for them, you know, not that they really had no respite much at all, very tiny, tiny bits of respite from that. And yet she's given pleasure to so many people through her works. And I find that really awe-inspiring. I think she's an incredibly brave and strong character.
You've written the following about the art of writing biography. You say it's an immersive experience. You read, write, live and breathe the subject for several years to the exclusion of all others. And then you say this often promotes fanciful identification between biographer and his or her subject. And I wondered when and how you might yourself have experienced this.
Well, I think I've tried to avoid it, and I hope I've been successful. The sort of, I was going to say problem, but that's probably not the right word, with having been such an early uptaker of Sylvia Townsend Warner, is that I did become very much the person that everybody would go to, including, I mean, her elderly friends and people left me things, you know. So I've got what I actually call the Sylvia Museum now. I'm fortunate to have possessions of hers, you know, and I do feel that there's a special relationship there. But I wouldn't dare to identify with her, because, I mean, her ghost would be slapping me back very, very sharply, I think. And the experience of having been awarded that, you know, access to her stuff and her life did make me quite early on be quite chary of getting too much into the mode of identifying with the subject. And in fact, I do tend to try and keep a distance or imagine a distance, so it's not too impertinent, you know, to be looking at somebody's private papers. I mean, that is a very strange feeling. I'm not actually a nosy person, and I'm not much of a gossip, so it's a strange thing to be doing, basically being nosy and gossiping about people all the time. But I do hope that I'm respectful of a sort of, well, at least alerting readers to the fact that they are being given access to some very private material. So, and I think that sort of feeds into the effectiveness of a biography too, not just to slam things down, you know, to make people aware that they are reading things that the writer would not have wanted them necessarily to read, but we're reading it in order to have a more sympathetic view of somebody, or to, you know, to enter into their world, certainly, and into the mind that made the writings that we are really primarily interested in. You know, I wouldn't want to just write about a person who, say, hadn't written books. I mean, I can't imagine writing a biography that wasn't a literary biography. I mean, for me, it enhances one's qualifications to be a reader of a particular writer. You know, it makes me into a better reader by writing the book, and I'm hoping that it will make readers of the biography into more appreciative readers of the subject.
What are you going to do next?
That's the awful question that comes up when you've just got something, you know, out of proof and into an actual finished copy
of
the book.
Yes, I'm sorry about that.
No, but I really actually don't know what I'm going to do next. I, as always, have several projects that I would like to do, and they're usually, I've got a kind of back catalogue of invisible books, you know, things I've wanted to do in the past. And there's a sort of, it's a bit like backstitch sometimes with subjects. You know, I wanted to write about Austin donkeys years ago and then was able to probably about 15 years after the initial impetus. And these, you know, one's interest simmers away and it's a private pleasure, but also, you know, there's a feeling that you could write about a particular subject. And there are at least three subjects I've in the past wanted to write about that, you know, they come back and you think, oh, yes, well, that's got legs, that could go. And also I do write short fiction and I do write poetry. So, I mean, I've always got something that's actually quite engrossing. Whether it will ever get, you know, these things get published or not is another matter altogether. But as to what I could actually say I would publish next, I really don't know.
That was Claire Harmon in conversation with Carolyn Sanderson. You can find out more about Claire on her website at www.clareharmon.com. That's Claire, spelled C-L-A-I-R-E, and Harmon, spelled H-A-R-M-A-N. And that concludes episode 255, which was recorded by Carolyn Sanderson and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 256, Susan Fletcher considers outsiderhood in life and fiction, and Lucy Flannery writes a novel by mistake. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.